How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a renowned actor, producer, director, playwright, author, and environmental advocate who's brought us many unforgettable performances in a stellar career that spans over five decades. You've seen him in dozens of movies, including Battlestar Galactica, Going South, Cat People, Eating Raoul, The Accidental Tourist, She-Devil, Best in Show, For Your Consideration, Whatever Works, Pineapple Express, Book Club, and A Mighty Wind, for which he and his fellow cast members won a Florida Film Critics Circle Award, as well as nominations for a Phoenix Film Critics Society Award and a Gold Derby Award for Best Ensemble Cast. On television, he is perhaps best known for his portrayal of Dr. Victor Ehrlich on the long-running hit series Saint Elsewhere, for which he received 6 Emmy Award nominations and a Golden Globe Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor. He's also known for playing Steve Fletcher on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, Gil Buckman on Parenthood, Dr. Jesse James on Kingdom Hospital, Hiram Gunderson on 6 Feet Under, Stan Sitwell on Arrested Development, Dr. Grant Linkletter on Young Sheldon, and Clifford Mayne on Better Call Saul, for which he and his fellow cast members received a Screen Actors Guild Award nomination for Outstanding Performance by an Ensemble. And he starred in numerous highly acclaimed TV movies, including Elvis, In the Best Interest of the Child, World War II, When Lions Roared, Incident at Deception Ridge, Georgia O'Keeffe, Muhammad Ali's Greatest Fight, and Recount. Our guest is also extremely well-known and highly respected for his advocacy and activism in raising public awareness about the need to save our planet, conserve our resources, protect the environment, and live a sustainable, eco-friendly, and green lifestyle. He's written 3 books on that subject: Living Like Ed, A Guide to the Eco-Friendly Life, Living Green, and Ed Begley Jr.'s Guide to Sustainable Living. And together with his wife, Rochelle, and daughter, Hayden, he created 2 reality TV series, Living with Ed and the multi-award-winning show On Begley Street. And he and Rochelle also host a popular podcast called Begley-esque. He also has a line of eco-friendly household cleaning products that we're going to hear about today. And if all of that weren't enough, our guest has also written a fascinating and highly entertaining memoir entitled To the Temple of Tranquility and Step on It. And I should also acknowledge that for 16 years, our guest served on the Board of Governors of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. I'm delighted and honored to welcome Ed Begley Jr. to our show. Ed, thank you so much for being here.
Harvey, it's so kind of you to have me on.
Now, Ed, I want to start by paying tribute to your father, the legendary Academy Award-winning actor Ed Begley. I know you became an actor primarily because you wanted to do what your father did, and I was really struck by something you wrote about him in your book. You said, and I'm quoting you here, "Although my father was not devoid of loyalty and kindness, the greater emphasis was on Darwinism as the principal guiding force in most matters." What did you mean by that?
It was kind of survival of the fittest, you know, keep up. I'm not going to slow down. You just got to keep up. And he had shorter legs than me. You know, when I was young, he had longer legs than me, of course. But when I got to be a teenager, my stride was a little better than his, so I could really keep up. But when I was a young boy, I had to really move fast to keep up. So don't get left behind was the general notion. He was very kind in many ways. He didn't leave me out in the cold, you know, figuratively or literally ever. But I learned to survive pretty early on. He wanted me to get tough. He sent me to military school so I'd get a little sense of responsibility, and it worked. I actually liked it.
In the 60s and 70s, you did stand-up comedy, and you opened for some big stars like Don McLean, Neil Sedaka, Loggins and Messina. You said that the comedians you looked up to were Richard Pryor, Jonathan Winters, and Red Fox, which is so interesting, Ed, because they all had this unfiltered and irreverent quality to their humor. Is that what drew you to them?
It did. You know, I like the old style comedians, one-liners and all that sort of thing. I like that a lot. Milton Berle with his delivery and great people who, you know, Rodney Dangerfield, certainly his wonderful career and his way of doing things. But the people like Richard Pryor and Jonathan Winters, who really became the characters, they just, you know, Mudbone in Richard Pryor's case, or Elwood P. Suggins for Jonathan Winters, they were actors and good actors, fine actors, and they didn't just show you the character, they became the character, like Lily Tomlin did in her wonderful play, The Search for Intelligent Life in the Universe. You know, to see acting on that scale, I went, wait a minute, there's something more than just jokes going on here. Jokes are fine, nothing wrong with jokes. That'll make an audience laugh really well too. But to become those characters as they did on stage, it was transformative. It was another wonderful chapter in comedy, I think.
Oh, for sure. In 1984, you got to host Saturday Night Live. Was that a career highlight for you?
Very much so. Any comedian that's honest will tell you, you know, to be on as a host or to be on in the cast of Saturday Night Live is something we all aspire to as comics. And so some friends of mine have done that. You know, Michael McKean was a dear friend of mine. He did it for years. Julia Dreyfus, when I hosted it, she was a regular cast member. Christopher Guest. Martin Short was in it that same year. Billy Crystal, my God, what a cast. And the writing staff included Larry David. It's just a stellar cast that year that I did it in 84. And it's you get high as a kite doing it just from the wonderful adrenaline experience. They tell you all week now, the 8:30 show, that it's not the live show, it's the one that kind of like the dress rehearsal. We're going to run it like it's a live show, so in case we get pieces that we can use, something goes wrong in the second show. But just don't be scared, because a lot of stuff's going to go wrong. Okay, thank you, I heard you. That's Monday. Tuesday, you know, we're going to do the 8:30 show. We're going to tape it, and we may use some of that, but it's going to go all wrong. I said, you told me that yesterday. Thank you. Wednesday, you know, things go kind of wrong at the 8:30. I heard you already. Thursday, the same thing. Friday, finally you do it Saturday. It goes so wrong in so many places. You go, you think your heart's going to stop, but all the adrenaline has been squeezed out of your body by that 8:30 show finishing up. So by the time you do the 11:30, you're kind of at one with the universe and you just do it, and it goes off very well, was my experience. And you just want to do it again the next week. It's heaven on earth for a comic, I think.
Yeah, that's a very interesting strategy they have to psych you up.
Yeah. And Lorne Michaels is brilliant. Though he came back to the show after a few years off. When I did it, he was off for a few years, but he came back and, you know, did that and many other things. The way it's structured is just brilliant. The kind of people that have gone through those doors are, you know, the best of the best.
Ed, you wrote that when you were a young actor, you had what you called a wake me when I'm famous attitude that kept you from putting in the necessary work to get cast in the really big roles. When did that attitude change to bring you the success that you've had for so many years?
I don't think it's unique to show business, that attitude that I had, which is, you know, in my case, in show business, wake me when I'm famous. The underlying theory being that you don't want to put in the work the way your parents did or other people that you knew, other relatives did. You know, I had a foot in the door because I was Ed Begley's son and didn't appreciate that fully at the time when I started working as an actor. And took me years to appreciate how lucky I was to be Ed Begley's son, because two things happen when you go in a job interview. One, they're going to remember your name, whether it's Liza Minnelli, Rob Reiner, you know, anybody, the son or daughter of anybody that famous, they're going to remember you. Number two, they have something to talk about, and they're kind of often rooting for you. Ed, top of page 8, we're going to begin in a moment. First of all, I worked with your dad on Philco Playhouse. He was wonderful. We did another wonderful show, Rod Serling's show, Patterns. We did that on live TV. So good luck. Top of page 8, Eddie. Let's go. Begin. They're kind of in your corner and they got something to talk about. So if you accept that gift, then you can be more relaxed and more energized or whatever you can take away from it. But my dad made it look so easy is the point that I thought, well, this is easy. Get me a TV series. I want to be on Wagon Train. I want to be on Gunsmoke. And not just one episode, Dad. Get me a whole you know, 13 episode commitment or something. I never said those words. He probably would have smacked me one or laughed his ass off. But I thought it many times. Why can't he just pick up the phone and get me a series, for God's sake? Like, A, he could do that. And B, more importantly, that I would appreciate it if he had done that. If he was somehow a studio head or somebody, a casting director that had the power to just get me a job like that. If he had just given it to me, I wouldn't have appreciated it. I said I wanted to be an actor a lot as a young man. So he said, well, that's up to you. I'm going to stay out of it. I don't want to push it. I don't want to say don't do it or push you into it. You do what you want.
You know, when we had Chris Lemon on the show, he's the son of Jack Lemon. He yes. said that being the son of a legendary star is a double-edged sword. Did you find that too?
It is if you, in my case, not, you know, Chris's experience is surely different. I work with the wonderful Jack Lemmon. He's great. And so is his son, Chris. They're both great. But mine was, you know, mine was a little bit different. I got nothing but positive out of it when I was ready to receive it. But at first I had that attitude for years. I thought, I'm not Ed Begley's, you know, my father. I'm not that guy. I'm a different guy, you know, so don't compare me to him. And finally realized, do whatever you want. Let me just read the script. If I'm good enough, give me the part. If I'm not, don't give it to me. I've got a leg up by being a son. It will open a door. It won't escort you through that door, but it will open it. You can kind of, you know, make your sales pitch to the people who are buying inside the other side of the threshold and win or lose on that. But you've definitely got a leg up if you're the son or daughter of anybody.
Oh, for sure. Now, Ed, we have a lot of B. Arthur fans in our audience, and I know that in 1972, you appeared in the very first episode of Maude. Do you have any memories you can share from that experience?
Working with B. Arthur, you know, she's a legendary Broadway star, a great, great actress, and to be in her presence was great. And also, I had met Norman Lear before that. I read for and did not get a part in a movie he did called Cold Turkey, about a town that quit smoking. And it was a very funny film. And then he went on to do All in the Family, of course. That had begun shooting at that point, taping at that point. And he had a new show called Maude, and Bill Macy was in it. You know, Bea Arthur was in it. And my first scene was with her, my first and only scene. I had one small scene, but I was a door-to-door salesman, you know, like a magazine salesman. I had a pitch that I was a Vietnam veteran, and Bea was just great, you know. Her character and her wonderful delivery said, oh, really? I was a war reporter myself. What unit did you work with? And I'm like, humana, 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 you know, because I didn't serve in Vietnam at all. You know, I was just trying to use that as a way to maybe sell some magazines. And it was a funny button to the scene. She slams the door on me. It was very funny stuff. So I was grateful to be around Norman, grateful to be around B. Arthur. And I was friends with Norman right up to the, you know, the last days of his life. I just loved that man. He gave me so many wonderful gifts, put me in another show called Mary Hartman, that really was a breakthrough kind of job for me. Another show called Year at the Top that didn't go anywhere, but it was still a wonderful job. And when the acting dried up for me a bit working for his company, I worked in some other shows at that time, but he knew I had a young family. He and Barbara Brogliotti, who worked for him, gave me a job taking still photographs on Mary Hartman, even though my character was gone on other shows that he did. And so I had a job, thanks to Norman Lear, that kept me and my family afloat. So he was a great and generous man and a dear friend. Everybody in LA and the world misses him in show business.
Oh, Norman Lear, what a legend. What an unforgettable contributor to pop culture. Now, you know, when I was doing my research for this interview and I was looking at your film career, I felt that Blue Collar was a movie that represented a shift in the types of roles that you were getting. Do you agree with that?
Very astute. Before that, I was kind of a Disney actor, and nothing wrong with that. You know, Kurt Russell is a dear friend, and it was good for him to be in those Disney movies. He went on and did other good things. One of them was a movie called Elvis, about Elvis Presley, in which he was sensational. I had a small part in it, playing his drummer, but Blue Collar was a different thing, and I got to be in that. And it was, you know, I was kind of going away from like the Disney blonde surfer characters I was getting and into something else. This factory work in Detroit with Yaphet Kotto and Harvey Keitel and Richard Pryor. It was just wonderful to work with those people. Lane Smith, Tracy Walter, these great, great actors. Boris Silver, just extraordinary. I just loved every single minute of it. And I love that movie. Paul Schrader is doing great movies to this day, getting nominated for Oscars and other fine awards and winning them. He's a great writer and a great friend, and hats off to Paul Schrader.
It was a great movie. You were great in it. I'm dying to ask you this question about cat people. You made it in 1981. So of course, at that time, there was no CGI. So how were you kept safe from that panther?
Yeah, 1981 was exactly the year, you're correct. We shot some of it in New Orleans, the beautiful town of New Orleans, and the rest we shot here. But when we pulled there's a scene, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the movie, just cover your ears for a minute. But I get my arm ripped off, as you and all the other viewers who have seen the movie know. So to do it that way, again, as you correctly stated, no CGI or anything like that. So they just did it old school. They had like some Karo syrup and some red food coloring and some rubber bands that kind of pulled away and then finally snapped to look like the tendons with the arm being ripped off. It looked really, really good, very realistic. And Paul Schrader was so good to me and so open with anything the other cast members would want to try. You know, you would think somebody who had their arm ripped off would scream bloody murder. And I said, well, let me try this. And I just kind of like, you know, the arm had just been pulled off and I was laying there. I'm just starting to shake, you know, like in shock as one would have if they had their arm ripped off. You know, I just kept looking around to John Hurt and to Ned O'Toole thinking, you know, am I going to be okay? And of course, the answer is no, you just had your arm ripped off. And we don't have a EMT standing by to, you know, tourniquet or, you know, forget about it. You're gone, buddy. And it was a powerful moment in the movie. And Paul really knows how to shoot a movie and to, you know, storyboard those sequences and make them play out effectively in the editing room. He's a gifted, gifted filmmaker. And the scene was great without any CGI.
But what about that panther? How much contact did you have to have with that animal?
Oh, good point for the stuff with the real panther. Yeah, they had, there was some mountain lions that they used some sort of food coloring and what have you to dye them so they look like panthers, but their face structure and everything is quite different. Wasn't as good. They had a mechanical panther too, I believe. That's my memory. I hope that memory is correct. But they definitely had real panthers, and the word was, do not mess with these cats at all. They will take you down so quick. They wouldn't, you know, with one paw, they'd just wipe you out. And so I needed to get kind of close to the cage, but not close enough for him to grab my real arm. And I had my real arm hidden and a fake arm on it. And the cat, you know, pulls it off and what have you. And the way it cut together, it was very effective, but there's a certain amount of danger. At one point I got too close. The guy said, dude, you got to listen to me. He will tear you apart. Do not get more than, you got to stay at least 18 inches away. This could have a whole different ending here on the set with you filming this movie. You know, do not get too close to the panther, I beg you. And I listened to him. He was a very wise animal handler.
Wow. Now, over the years, Ed, you've gotten to know some of the greatest legends of all time. I'd like to mention some of these people and ask you what comes to mind when you hear their name. Let me start with John Belushi.
Friend and savior. That's the two words I'd use. And I would throw Judy Belushi in with it because I was so far gone at that point. John and certainly Judy both were a sobering influence on my life. I was in such bad shape. I was a cause of great concern to John Belushi. That's where I was at.
Well, that's saying a lot.
It is saying a lot. And sadly, we lost him, you know, but that's just luck of the draw. I would have done all those things he did that night.
But he was such an influence on you to help you get sober, but he couldn't do it for himself.
Well, he didn't see it coming, I think. And he was with some people who were, you know, not good influences on him. You know, the woman who scored the heroin that he did, you know, near the end. I mean, everybody, when they heard that, they went, this is a setup. John would never have done that. He never would have put a needle in his arm, which is true, until the last 2 weeks of his life. And then he did, you know, because I had a friend who was with him that night. My friend Nelson Lyon was with him earlier that evening. And but I don't want to remember John Belushi by that night or that unfortunate last couple of weeks. He was one of the great comics, physical comics, and, you know, of my time in Hollywood, one of the great comedic actors around, dramatic actor. He could do anything. Great actor, great comedian, and we all miss him still.
Very much so. What about John Lennon? What are your memories of him?
Kind and open, if I'm going to pick two words to describe him. He, when I first met him with Harry Nilsson, he opened the door to his flat there at the Dakota Hotel where he lived with Yoko and his son. And there was no help in evidence. Yoko Ono had made a meal, an organic kind of a macrobiotic meal herself. And we sat around and talked. And He just wanted to be treated like an ordinary bloke, and he had every appearance that he was just that. They would walk around in Central Park with no security detail, just pushing the pram, you know, with their child in it, and say hello to people and shake their hands and what have you. And that openness, sadly, I guess, was his undoing. He was so open that that sad day occurred there at the Dakota that broke everybody's heart, including mine. Yeah, great man.
Terrible tragedy. Now, I know that you worked with Bishop Desmond Tutu on prison reform and enhancing social justice. Can you tell me about your time working with him?
The work I did with him was mostly stuff, you know, trying to end apartheid. You know, I had Alfred Wood and other friends introduce me to him, but also we talked about prison reform because of the time that Nelson Mandela spent in prison, what have you. You know, it was something he cared deeply about, and other friends were working on that too. But I had just been in prison myself in county jail for just a few days and was, you know, terrified and traumatized and everything just a few days. And I ultimately had people that would bail me out, and other people in the other parts of Los Angeles and the world don't have that same luxury. So Desmond Tutu was a great man. I was honored to know him and work with many issues on him. And that's just one of them.
Yeah, I'm glad I got a chance to mention that in this interview. And speaking of jail, for a while, you were friends with O.J. Simpson, correct?
I was. I met him on the way to Albuquerque. He was doing a movie. I was doing a TV movie in 1979. And he and Nicole were very friendly and very nice. And we spent time together. And then they divorced. And nobody that I knew in my circle of friends knew anything about the spousal abuse that was going on. It was known to just a few of her family members and others. And that's what that case unfortunately is. It's the worst kind of ending for a case about spousal abuse. But we were, after he got divorced, we were friendly still. Again, me and all the crowd I hung with knew nothing about that sad part of his life, sad and horrible part of his life. So when it happened, everybody was like saying it ain't so. We couldn't believe it at first that a guy so nice to us and everybody would do that sort of thing. But it was sadly the case. She had been collecting Polaroids and putting them in her safe deposit box of different injuries she had sustained and what have you. So it was just tragic, tragic, heartbreaking, tragic thing to see somebody descend into that state of mind. But there's a lot of information we know now we didn't know about then. Not to forgive for one second what he did, what I believe he did, but you know, head injuries and what have you, he sustained as a football player, you know, that can really mess you up and make you, you know, do things you wouldn't otherwise do.
Yeah, that's something to think
about. It's tragic. And now he's gone. And I don't know if that ever gives any closure to, you know, Ron Goldman's family and, you know, his and Nicole's family as well. It just, I don't think any of it makes them feel any better. I don't know. I haven't seen them in years. All very good people. It's just a horrible, horrible chapter when somebody that brilliant, you know, in sports or in any field, goes through that sort of has that kind of a downfall. It's just horrible. And much more horrible on the victims, of course, Nicole and other people that are victims of spousal abuse. That's the big takeaway from this. We have to make sure women have a way out, a place to go, a shelter or something when that's going on, so they don't put themselves in harm's way. That's really the takeaway from that, in my opinion.
Amen. And as a retired criminal court judge, I can't agree more. Now, you were friends with Marlon Brando, who had one golden rule. Everybody knew this. He did not want to talk about anything having to do with show business. Did you ever find it difficult to comply with that rule?
I did, but I just bit my tongue. The only time I talked about it briefly was when there was a misunderstanding, because he called me one day saying, you know, he had a project that he wanted to do with me. After all this time, Ed, there's a project I want to work with you on a project. I thought, wow, that sounds great. He's talking about a movie or something. And I've got the financing. Oh, he's definitely talking about a movie. We have distribution. Oh, he's definitely, definitely talking about a movie. As it turns out, he was talking about a way to put electric eels in a pool and get electricity from the electric eels, which is not, I'll jump ahead in the story and tell you, not at all practical, but he really believed it could be done, that you could harness the power from electric eels. And sadly, that isn't so. But the other thing I recognized, besides not wanting to talk about show business, he definitely, he didn't want to be proven wrong about things, but more importantly, he didn't want sycophants. He didn't want people to just go, oh, Marlin, what a wonderful idea. Electric eels, it's going to run the whole world. You know, he wanted to push back and discover if it was real or not. And I fortunately guided him in the direction of not wasting any more time on it, because there's no way you're going to light up a hobbyist light bulb at a science fair, even, you know, with electric eels. There's not enough current, sustained current, to do anything of any value.
You know, when I read your book and I think of the legendary people that you've gotten to know and work with, it's really quite astounding. In 1978, I think it was, you appeared with Jack Nicholson in a movie called Going South, and he also directed that movie. What was he like to work with as a director?
He was such a good friend. He gave me the part as an act of friendship. You know, my wife at the time, my first wife, wonderful Ingrid, you know, said, call him up. He's doing a movie. He's your friend. Call him up and see if he can get a job. I said, I'm not going to call him up. The reason I'm his friend is because I never ask him for anything. I'm not calling him. She finally wore me down. I called him up knowing that it'd be the last time I ever heard from him. And he said, let me talk to the writers to get back to you. He said, see, he's trying to get out of it now. Call the writers to get back to you. I'm never going to hear from him again. Like 2 days later, he went, Beggs, I got a part for you. Be playing the part of Whitey Beggs. You think you can handle that? So I played a character named Whitey, and it has to do with a bank robbery that happens. But he's robbing Mary Steenburgen's money, taking her money out of the bank. And I had, at that point, this was 1977 that we did the movie. At that point, I had been in Screen Actors Guild for 10 full years. And I had, at some point, a couple of years into that 10-year span, gotten relaxed around the camera. And I spent the remaining like 8 years, whatever it was to that point, being relaxed in front of the camera. And that's not exactly what you want to do in every movie, be relaxed and kind of, you want to have some zip, something going on in many different kinds of scenes, what have you. You want to have something that's something going on behind my vacant eyes, you know, and I didn't quite figure that one out. So Jack, after I did the first take of the scene we were doing, he said, is that all you're going to give me, Beggs? And my heart is pounding, you know, like a jackhammer. I couldn't believe it. Give me one more take, Jack. I'm sorry. And I was so filled with adrenaline, I decided I'd turn that fear and that anxiety into energy and infuse the scene with it. And I pulled it off. And then I realized there's more to acting than just being relaxed. That's a good tool of the many tools in your toolbox. Sometimes you need to be relaxed. Sometimes you need to be, you know, it's showtime, you know, and kind of get something going and have something going on in the background. And just look at the fine work that Joaquin Phoenix does, Elizabeth Moss, or Meryl Streep, or Daniel Day-Lewis, these great actors, Jack Nicholson, people that I work with, like Meryl and Jack, on set. You can see it. You certainly see it in the movies, what they're doing. There's lots going on behind their eyes. They're experiencing many different emotions. So the audience gets to take that ride with them. And you begin to wonder in Sophie's Choice, what happened to this poor woman, Sophie, in that wonderful movie, Sophie's Choice? At some point, you discover the choice she had to make and what that means, and it's just devastating. And that's what great acting is about, the kind of work she does in every movie. And I'm still learning from just watching her.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Meryl Streep. You worked with her in She-Devil. I want to ask you, Ed, when you get to know a co-star well, how does that impact your acting with them?
It just helped me. Everything that she did on the set, you know, and between shots, she just did it, helped inform me as an actor. She assisted me. She had ideas for me. I, of course, embraced them instantly. As she thought the scene would be better standing in my head, I'd say, get a couple of grips. Come over here. Help me up. Help get my legs up in the air. Like this, Meryl, what would you like me to, you know, I would do anything she said, because she was so smart about everything. And she would take a scene that was written okay, and she would make it into this little gem, and the Susan Seidelman would say, no, I think you should do it this way, which was, in my opinion, not as good as what she had just done on her own. And Meryl would say, oh, okay, sure. Take that sow's ear and turn it into a silk purse and do Susan Seidelman's way. And that was equally brilliant. It was just incredible working with her. She would just take anything that was asked of her and turn it into a gem. And she still does it to this day. Every movie she's in, she's got some secret going on in the background, you know, that kind of let us into your underwear kind of thing, you know, where there's something squirming inside you and you don't know what it is. And everybody wants to know what happened to Joaquin Phoenix in that wonderful movie, The Master. Who is this guy and what happened to him before he's meeting up with, you know, the other characters in the movie, you know. It's just amazing movie. Did you see that movie, by the way, Master?
Oh, of course, yes.
Wonderful. Joaquin Phoenix, great in everything, great in The Joker. What happened to this guy that turns out to be the Joker? And you see a bit of it with his mother, played brilliantly by Frances Conroy. You see some of the backstory of the Joker, and you begin to understand how this person got that way. It's just a joy to watch.
It sure is. You were once told by acting coach Roy London that the most interesting and compelling thing to watch in an actor is how they deal with pain. Do you agree with that?
I didn't at all at the time. When he told me that, I kind of went, wow, that's great. I gotta try to implement that more. Thanks. Oh, look at the time. I gotta run, Roy. Thanks so much. I got out to my car. I thought, what a bunch of crap. What a load of baloney. I'm in pain. I'm in pain. Who wants to see that all the time? Garcia Lorca's Blood Wedding. It's, oh, we're in pain and life is pain. And then I got in my car and started to drive. I went, wait a second. I had to pull over, actually. I went, that wasn't what he said at all. He didn't say anything about a character showing pain or experiencing physical pain, how a character deals with pain, how you tried to keep the lid on that pot, how Sophie's character tries to keep the lid on it so things don't explode. You know, what happens to Bob De Niro's character in Mean Streets, you know, that character that he plays so brilliantly, and that what he goes through with that, or Casino, pick any movie that Bob De Niro has done, you know, Taxi Driver, those great roles that he's had. What happened to this guy? And you begin to learn what happened to him. In Breaking Bad, another great example of great storytelling. Vince Gilligan, and this is played brilliantly, of course, by the wonderful cast of Breaking Bad. There's a motorhome going through the desert, and a pair of pants fly in the air. The motorhome blows by. What does that mean? You know, what the hell did I just see? What does that mean? And you learn very quickly in the next 20 minutes what that means, how that happened. And that's great storytelling. That's what we need to do as actors, what Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould do every week, and the brilliant shows that they do, like Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. I want to know more about this. What happened to this character? How did he or she get this way? And I realized Roy London was right. It's universal. How Laurel and Hardy deal with pain, carrying a piano down a flight of stairs, and they fall. The piano falls on them. Could you imagine, Harvey, a piano falling on you as you're falling downstairs? That would be extremely painful. But we're laughing our ass off because we know it's all fun and, you know, no danger. It's just an actor in a comedy. Harold Lloyd is hanging from the hands of a clock very high up. Can you imagine hanging on to metal hands of a clock? How sharp it would be on your fingers and what have you. Incredible pain, yet we're laughing like crazy. And that's the genius of what Roy said. He was right. It's universal. How a character deals with pain is what you want to see in a scene, a play, a movie, a TV show, anything, how they deal with it.
You know, you've had great success in your career, Ed, but you've said that you feel your biggest talent was being in the right place at the right time. How much of your success do you attribute to good luck?
First of all, let's start with the original good fortune of being born Ed Begley's son. Can we just start there? You know, Ed Begley's son, many other wonderful people that I mentioned, sons and daughters of, to be born into that kind of household that has such talent and access was my first bit of good luck. And then getting on these shows and not getting fired, like Room 222, Adam 12, Mannix, all those shows where I did, and I was kind of learning on the job. I was still very aware of the camera. Oh God, don't look at the camera, don't look at the camera. The camera's right over there, don't look at the camera. And then finally, as I said earlier, I got relaxed and was never worried that the camera could dolly around, have a snorkel cam going around in anything, whatever direction the lens was. I was never aware. I was aware of the camera, but I never looked at the camera. I got relaxed. Good. I'm done, right? Not remotely. I hadn't even begun. Forget about done. I needed to get something going on behind my vacant eyes. Relaxed is fine in some circumstances, but totally not fine, not at all what is required in other things like the fine work I mentioned. Another dear friend I got to cite because he just died a few weeks ago, Dabney Coleman. Any movie, 9 to 5 on Golden Pond, Slap Maxwell, Buffalo Bill. What happened to this guy? You think this is the meanest guy I've ever met. This guy's such a jerk. How did he get that way? And it's totally real. Dabney Coleman has never once been in a comedy. I mean, he's listed to the cast in a comedy, but he's not doing comedy. He's doing Ibsen. He's doing Shakespeare. He's doing, you know, Chekhov. And that's what makes it so great. He and Marilyn Mercer in these wonderful shows, you know, like Mary Hartman, doing this incredible work that they did. They're not playing it for laughs. They're playing it real as can be. As but Mudbone, the character Richard Pryor did, he's not really playing it for laughs. There's laughs in it, but because he's become the character Mudbone. And that's what it's about. Dowdy was always real to his bone as an actor, and it comes across as great comedy, which it is.
Oh, he was a genius. Now, Ed, you disclosed something very personal in your book, that a number of years ago you received quite a shock when you discovered that your real mother was not your father's wife, Amanda, but a woman named Sandy who worked at NBC. And you also discovered that your brother Tom is actually your father's sister's son, so he's really your cousin. How did you cope with those revelations, and why did you want us to know that?
Because of that very reason, what you just said, I didn't cope with them well at all. How did I cope with it? Not remotely well. I decided to seek refuge and to numb the pain with drugs and then alcohol. I decided to that I couldn't take the pain, so I didn't want to really experience it. And if you don't experience pain, you never learn anything. And you also get to, you don't get to fully experience pleasure either as well. You know, you're not going to experience any pain or pleasure much. So that's going to change the way you do things. You're not going to learn any lessons and grow. So if you start drinking as I did and using back when I was about 16, and you then get sober when you're 30 years old, when you turn 30, you're not really 30 as far as emotional development. You're 16 or 17 because you didn't learn those lessons you should have learned at 19 and 20 and 21 and 22 because you were numb. So that's what one chooses to do. It's not, I don't recommend it. Didn't work out very well for me when I was doing that, but there was a great gift in that. And that gift is sobriety. And I've been fortunate enough to be sober since the late 70s. So I'm quite lucky at that. And a little bit smart for going to recovery groups and seeking help there.
But it's very interesting what you just said, because when you look at your life, I would say that between 1967 and 1979, according to you in your own book, you were indulging in a daily regimen of alcohol and drugs. But you did say in your book that you believe alcohol probably saved you before it nearly killed you. What did you mean by that?
It's kind of a heresy to some in recovery, but I really believe it to be true. There's many people besides me who think that. I was so traumatized and such a wreck, I needed to be sedated in some way. It could have been through meditation. It could have been through, you know, I would recommend something like that, getting help with the therapy, you know, that's to deal with it in that way. I chose to deal with it, to sedate myself with actual substances, drugs and alcohol, and that I don't recommend at all. But I was such a wreck, I needed help in some way, and I chose the wrong choice. I made the wrong choice and chose the wrong way of dealing with it. And that didn't work out well at all, as I said. But, you know, you got to do something when you have that kind of anxiety in your life, and just make sure you pick wisely. But there's surprises sometimes. Sometimes pain, you know, occurs, and there's a blessing in that even. You know, I had kidney stones recently, and it's very painful. And I went, why did this happen to me? Another thing, I've got other physical challenges. Now I got kidney stones. It's horrible. Kidney stones were one of the greatest gifts that happened to me a year ago. What do I mean by that? Well, the car was up in the rack, if you will, while I was sedated and under to take care of the kidney stones. The doctor did something he was not asked to do. I didn't ask him to do it. But since he was there already, he went and looked into the bladder and found a tumor the size of a pea. Okay, Harvey, just a little one the size of a pea. Took it out, had a biopsy done. It was cancerous. He discovered it because I had kidney stones. You never find them when they're that small in the bladder. You just don't. You're not going to find it until it's much bigger and it's spread, you know, nearly all the time. When they get that big, there's not a lot you can do with it. You can lose your bladder, have their bladder taken out, and deal with everything that goes with that. But the size of a pea, they can excise it, which they did, and it does not grow back. So kidney stones even were a gift for me because of what ultimately came of it, which is I did not get bladder cancer because we found something at the earliest possible conceivable stage.
Ed, that's what you call destiny, big time.
Definitely.
Wow. So if there's someone watching this interview right now who's struggling with a substance abuse problem, what advice would you give them?
There's lots of 12-step groups out there, you know, groups that help you, whatever you're trying to get help with. You want to stop gambling, you want to stop philandering, you know, there's Love Addicts Anonymous, and there's certainly like AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and Al-Anon to support people who are the sons or daughters of, or wives or husbands of. So there's that, and there's NA, which is, you know, for narcotics and what have you. So there's recovery groups. It really boils down to a very simple sentence, which is, I can't, but we can. That is to say, a group, you can do it. You can't do it alone. And I certainly tried to get sober for years and had no success at it, but I can't, but we can really summed up my recovery. When I got involved with other people and tried to do it as a team effort, you could call somebody up in the middle of the night and say, I'm about to take a drink. Okay, hold, hang on the line. I'm coming right over there, you know, and we'll get through this. And that's the way it works. One person helping another, you know, one and one equals three in this case.
Well, that's for sure. And I'm so glad that you overcame your addictions. You overcame the pain you were trying to numb. I'm so happy they got rid of that little tumor and that you're okay now. Now, as I mentioned in my introduction, you are a highly visible and vocal advocate for the environment and global sustainability. Where did your interest in the environment come from?
It started at the earliest age growing up in Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley. We had horrible choking smog back then. It just seared your lungs to forget about playing in a play yard, to just sit on a bench and try to breathe in and breathe out. It hurt. I was like an asthmatic, but I did not have asthma. I would breathe as all my friends did like that. It was just difficult to breathe. The pollution was so high. So when they started Earth Day in 1970, I went, this is a fine day to celebrate the Earth, but what are we going to do the next day and the one after that? What about the other 364 days? What's the plan for Earth Day? They went, we're going to clean up the air. We're going to clean up the water. I went, shake my hand. I'm with you. Let's do this. And in a way, we did. We haven't cleaned up all the air pollution in the world or even in California, certainly not in our city, but we've cleaned up so much of it. We have four times the cars since 1970, that first Earth Day. Four times the cars, millions more people in LA, but a fraction of the smog. The air is much, much cleaner than 1970. Now, having said that, we need to get some relief for the people around Long Beach and the port of Los Angeles and near the shipping centers or fulfillment centers where diesel trucks are idling and freeway interchanges where people, you know, people who don't have a lot of means at their disposal to move or, you know, to take care of, to buy an air purifier even, they're getting a lot of pollution in those areas. We need to fix that too, but we've proven that we can do it. Cleaner power plants, cleaner vehicles, cleaner everything, and the air got cleaner. No big surprise there. We hoped it would work and it did work.
Well, it's well known that you live in a solar-powered home, you drive an electric car when you're not riding your bike, and all of your choices revolve around minimizing waste. But you've said that you consider yourself a strategic opportunist more than an environmentalist. What did you mean by that?
I just decided to do this and try to hide my real reasons for doing it from people. My real reason was to clean up the environment, save as many plant and animal species as I can, and make a better planet for my children and grandchildren. That was my real reason. But if I couch it in other ways, that, hey, I know you don't want to talk about climate change because you have a different philosophy about that than me, but what about just saving money on your utility bills, lessening our dependence on foreign oil, you know, cleaning up the air in our cities of Houston and Bakersfield? What about doing that? We don't have to ever talk about climate change again. Let's do those three things. So I like to get other people in the fold that, you know, the front door is closed and locked to certain conversations about things in certain parts of the country and the world. So let's not get bogged down in that. Let's go around to the side door and have a chat about, you know, cleaning up the air in our cities, lessening our dependence on foreign oil, and putting money in our pockets. Three very conservative values that my dad adhered to and I do too. I have nothing but wonderful conservatives in my life that have helped me, you know, discover how to live a conservative lifestyle, as in conserving money, conserving the environment. You know, it's a good way to live, and we can't do it alone. We need to have a lot of help to do it, both sides of the aisle.
Well, you're an amazing role model, and you have been long before it became fashionable. Tell me about your line of household cleaning products.
Well, when I started in 1970, I didn't have a lot of money to buy fancy cleaning products. And I knew stuff, you know, different, you know, spray bottles and detergents and what have you had toxic elements. So I just used vinegar and water to clean up and baking soda. And that was fine. That did a certain job, but I wanted something that worked better. And so I met some guys that had a good formula. And I have some cleaning products now that are very good. We have a pet stain and odor remover. We've got, you know, quite a few products that we're working on right now, but we have them in Costco and we have a mail order. Just look for Begley's Earth Responsible Products. Begley's, just type in Begley Cleaning and it'll come right up. We have some wonderful cleaning products that are non-toxic and do a great, great job of cleaning.
You can also learn more about and purchase the Begley line of natural household products by going to the website begleysbest.com. Now, Ed, in 2016, 8 years ago, you were diagnosed with Parkinson's, which you've actually had since 2004. My dad had Parkinson's for 33 years, so I'm very familiar with it. How are you doing now, Ed? How are you feeling? No tremor.
Isn't that something? This is what you could do in 2024. They have great medications that help you. I have a neurologist that's wonderful and gave me some great help with the very normal go-to medications for Parkinson's. That's A. Then for extra credit, Harvey, my wonderful wife, Rochelle, wanted to try some other stuff, holistic stuff that would work with, not in place of, the stuff the neurologists know that keeps my hand that steady. And that is, we've been doing something called glutathione, something called NAD. And we've been doing, long before I knew I had Parkinson's, this was my salvation that kept me from knowing it for years. I had it, I didn't even know I had it, Harvey, because every day, vigorous, strenuous exercise, every day. I go to the gym every day now, and I do 30 minutes of vigorous riding on a life cycle at fairly high levels. And then I do the full upper body circuit. Everyday exercise works very, very well. And so I'm doing that kind of thing, eating well, exercise. And I, as I said, glutathione has helped me, NAD has helped me, and B1 is also very helpful for some people. It's helped me as well. And I'm always trying new things. Some of them work, some of them don't work. I've kissed a lot of frogs, but I've got a nice program now of stuff that works that we've tried and very scientifically, trial and error, you know, has worked very well for me. I've had it a long time and I'm still doing very, very good.
Knock wood, I am so happy to hear this. You know, Ed, I know you're too humble to mention this, but I want to acknowledge publicly that you worked with Cesar Chavez on improving working conditions for farm laborers. You were a pallbearer at his funeral. And in 2003, you wrote and produced a multi-award-winning show about his life's work called Cesar and Reuben. And in 2004, you received the Cesar Chavez Legacy Award for your many years of social justice advocacy. I just want to publicly congratulate you, Ed. Thank you for everything you do to promote inclusivity, equality, and social justice.
Thank you for saying that, Harvey. That's very nice. And I'm sure you know the work continues. Dolores Huerta is a dear friend of mine. She worked with Cesar Chavez and forming the United Farm Workers. She's still out there doing the important work, and I see her often and love her, so I get to continue to work on those matters with Dolores Huerta, and I'm very lucky to have known those two heroes in my time. I never met Dr. King or Mahatma Gandhi or Mother Teresa, but I know those two people, and boy, they are something else. Like Jane Goodall, people have really done positive things for the world, and we thank them for it.
I just think you exemplify the best way to use the power of being a celebrity through your work with Bishop Desmond Tutu and Cesar Chavez and working for the environment. I really only have one more question for you, Ed, and it's this. One of the key life lessons in your book that really resonated with me is stop racing around trying to find it. You already have it. So my question is this. Was there one key moment in your life that inspired that piece of wisdom?
Yes. Different people say different things to you, and sometimes they really resonate. There's a wonderful philosopher called Alan Watts, W-A-T-T-S, like a kilowatt. Alan Watts, he wrote a book called This Is It. And I was given the book by my friend Neil Rhodes, and I got the book right away. I leafed through it, and I jumped around it, and I could see that the title of the book was the book, really, was the idea of the book, which is, this is it, Harvey, this moment. Right now, this one between you and I is as good as it gets. You know, there's a saying, don't just do something, stand there. Again, we have plenty of work to do. We can't stand there forever. But when you can, find some quiet time, find some stillness in your life and capture this moment. Here it comes again, Harvey, where we can be serene if you choose to. Then you get to go out and help the United Farm Workers, help the environmental justice people are out there working so hard to get clean water and clean air for people. You can be of real service because you're centered yourself, you're steady, you're not fractured and all over the place. Try to do two things well, then rather than, as I used to do, 20 things poorly. Focus on just a few things, do them with all the effort that you possess, but find some stillness in your life, get centered so you can be of help to the many causes that need it.
Well, Ed, if this is as good as it gets, I have to tell you, I got to the top of the mountain today. It has been such a pleasure meeting you, having this opportunity to chat with you about your amazing life and career, your truly inspirational passion for raising public awareness about social justice, about the need to protect the environment. I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to appear on our show. Thank you, Ed.
Right back at you. I get a great feeling from you, Harvey. I hope I get to meet you live in person one day. You're just wonderful. I loved your questions and your whole manner. It's a delight to meet you.
Thank you so much, and we will make that happen. Our guest has been the renowned actor, author, and environmentalist Ed Begley Jr. For more information about Ed Begley Jr., his blogs, his podcasts, and his line of eco-friendly products, please go to his official website, begleyliving.com. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.